Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today feels a little bit like graduation day, doesn't it?
It really does. We are crossing the finish line.
We are. We're tackling the finale, Class 5 of the Quantum Law course. The title alone is, it's a lot. From causation to probability.
It's been quite a trajectory to get here. I mean, if you look back at where we started, we've gone from the real nuts and bolts of quantum mechanics, you know, the hardware, the qubits.
Right, the machinery.
The machinery. Then we got into the terrifying reality of Q-Day and encryption. And then we spent time in the courtroom looking at quantum evidence and artificial intelligence.
Exactly. And the way I see it, those first four classes were all about the how. You know, how the machines work, how they break codes, how they optimize logistics or discover evidence. But this one, class five, feels different. This feels like we're finally asking the why, and maybe even the big one. What does it all mean?
That is the perfect way to frame it. If the previous classes were the mechanics manual, this is the philosophy seminar.
A philosophy seminar with extremely high stakes.
Exactly. It's not just navel gazing. Mm-hmm. We're shifting our focus from that mechanical view of the world, what the course calls the clockwork universe of classical physics, to the shadow of infinity that is quantum reality.
The shadow of infinity. It sounds like the title of a sci-fi novel, but in this context, it's actually a structural legal problem, isn't it?
It is the ultimate legal problem.
Yeah.
Our whole mission for this deep dive is to grapple with a very specific, very difficult transition. How does legal judgment even survive when certainty is replaced by probability?
And this is where we get into the really wild stuff.
Oh, yeah. We're going to examine the argument that the existence of the multiverse, and yes, I mean parallel worlds, might actually be the most logical explanation for the reality we live in, and by extension, the laws we have to enforce.
Okay, we have to unpack that, because multiverse is a trigger word for a lot of people.
Yeah.
It usually signals that we've left the realm of serious legal discussion and, you know, entered a comic book movie.
Right. It sounds like fiction.
But before we get there, we need to understand what we're leaving behind. Because most lawyers, and honestly most people, operate on a very specific assumption about cause and effect.
They do. That's the classical worldview. And we owe that mostly to Isaac Newton and James Clerk Maxwell. We call it the clockwork model.
The universe as a giant predictable machine.
A perfect machine. If you know the position and speed of every particle, and you know all the forces acting on them, you can predict the future flawlessly. It's deterministic.
And more importantly for law, if it's a machine, you can run it backward. You can rewind the tape.
Precisely. Think about any standard negligence claim. A car crash, a slip and fall. The law asks of a very specific question. But for the defendant's actions, would the injury have occurred?
The but-for test. It's torts 101.
It's the bedrock. And it assumes that if we could magically rewind time and just remove that one negligent act, take one gear out of the clock, the rest of the movie would play out exactly the same, just without the bad ending.
It treats history as a single, solid line, like a railroad track.
Exactly. It relies on a concept that the course calls identity. The idea that A always equals A, and if you repeat the experiment, you get the exact same result. It assumes the past is fixed and the future is inevitable if you just know all the variables.
But then the 20th century happened.
Then the quantum revolution happened. In came the disruptors.
Max Planck, Einstein, Niels Bohr, Heisenberg, Dirac, Schrodinger, the whole crew.
The whole crew. And they looked really closely at reality and found that at the most fundamental level, it isn't a clock, it isn't a line, it's a probability distribution.
So are we saying that, strictly speaking, the but-for test, the foundation of our entire liability system, is based on bad physics?
It's based on physics that works great for baseballs and planets, but it completely fails at the level where reality is actually built. In quantum reality, A doesn't just cause B. A creates a wave of probabilities where B, C, D, and E are all possible outcomes.
And this is where that other key term comes in. We're moving from a world of identity to a world of fidelity.
Yes. That's a word that keeps popping up in the course, and for good reason.
Explain that distinction. Identity versus fidelity.
Fidelity means we can only be true to the process of probability. We can't guarantee a single outcome, but we can be faithful to the statistical truth of the system. We can't promise the coin will land on heads, but we can be faithful to the fact that it's a 50-50 process. That distinction is the anchor for this entire class.
I appreciate that distinction. It grounds the physics in something lawyers can, you know, actually work with. And speaking of grounding, the narrative structure of this class is fascinating because it doesn't just throw equations at us.
No, it tells stories.
It focuses on three specific protagonists who represent three different ways of grappling with this new quantum reality. We have the theorist, the evidence gatherer, and the builder.
And I love this structure because it shows the evolution of the idea. It moves from, is this even possible? To, wait, is this real? And finally to, okay, what can we build with it?
So let's start with the theorist. This is Hugh Everett III. And I have to say, his story is one of the most compelling and frankly tragic things we've covered in this entire course.
Hugh Everett III is a figure who really, really deserves to be better known. We're talking about the mid-1950s. He was a PhD student at Princeton. And he was brilliant. Maybe too brilliant for his own good.
Oh, so.
Well, he was looking at the math of quantum mechanics, specifically the Schrodinger equation, and he noticed something really strange about how everyone else was interpreting it. So he decided to do something incredibly radical. He decided to take the math literally.
What does that even mean, taking it literally? I mean, isn't that what you're supposed to do in physics?
You'd think so, but not in this case. The standard interpretation at the time was the Copenhagen interpretation, which was championed by the legendary Niels Bohr. It said that particles exist in this cloud of possibilities, a superposition, but the moment you measure them, that cloud collapses into one single reality.
Right, the famous collapse of the wave function. The cat is either dead or alive, the electron is either here or there. The act of observing forces the universe to make up its mind.
But Everett looked at the Schrodinger equation and asked a very simple question. Why? There's absolutely nothing in the math that suggests a collapse. The equation doesn't have a stop sign. He argued that the wave function never collapses, it just devolves. Every single possible outcome actually happens.
And this is the birth of the many worlds interpretation.
He originally called it the relative state formulation.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, much less catchy, but more mathematically accurate. But yes, this is the foundation of the multiverse theory.
So how should we visualize this? The course brings back an analogy from class one.
The water in the maze analogy. Remember that one?
Yes. The classical computer is like a single mouse running through a maze, hitting dead ends one by one until it finds the cheese. The quantum computer is like water flooding the maze, exploring every single path at once.
Exactly. Everett argued that the universe itself is like that water. It doesn't choose one path through the maze of history. It fills all of them simultaneously. We as observers are just floating along in one little trickle of that water, completely unaware that all the other channels even exist. But according to the math, they are just as real as our channel is.
So, hold on. In another channel, I'm having this conversation with you, but I'm wearing a different shirt. And in another one, I decided not to host a podcast at all, and I'm, I don't know, a professional fisherman.
In infinite variations, yes.
Yeah.
Every single time a quantum event has a probability of going one way or another, the universe splits. Both things happen.
That is such a heavy concept, and I have to imagine in the deeply conservative academic environment of the 1950s, you know, the button-up world of post-war physics, that wasn't exactly embraced.
The not embraced is the understatement of the century. It was considered heresy. You have to understand the politics of the time. Everett's advisor was John Archibald Wheeler, a titan of physics, the guy who coined the term black hole.
A
total legend. And Wheeler saw the brilliance in what Everett was doing, but he also practically worshipped Niels Bohr. He considered Bohr the father of the field, the pope of physics.
So Wheeler stuck between his brilliant, radical student and his idol.
Exactly. And he wanted to keep the peace. He wanted to protect the establishment. So he tried to whitewash Everett's ideas. He tried to water them down, make them sound compatible with Bohr's Copenhagen interpretation when they were fundamentally at odds. It's a classic example of an intellectual chilling effect.
Right. The institution prioritizes consensus over actual evidence.
And it wasn't just Wheeler being polite, right? The reaction from Bohr's camp was just hostile.
How hostile?
Brutal. There's a quote from one of Bohr's closest collaborators, a man named Leon Rosenfeld. He reviewed Everett's PhD thesis and called him undescribably stupid for challenging the status quo.
Wow. Undescribably stupid. That's not a critique of the math. That's a character assassination.
It crushed him. It absolutely crushed Everett. You have to imagine, this was his life's work. This was his great insight into the nature of reality. And the establishment basically told him to go away and shut up. So
yeah.
He did.
He just gave up on it.
He essentially left academia, He took his brilliant mathematical mind and went to work for the Department of Defense. He started working on nuclear war games, optimizing weapon deployment strategies.
So he went from trying to understand the creation of all possible universes to figuring out how to blow this one up.
In a way, yes. He left the mysteries of creation to calculate the fallout of destruction. And reading the biographical notes in the course, his personal life seemed to reflect that detachment. It's a very, very sad story.
It really is. There's a heartbreaking description from his son, Mark Oliver Everett. And for our listeners who are music fans, you might actually know him. He's E, the frontman of the band Eels.
Which is just a wild connection in itself, right?
Yeah.
A rock star, son of a multiverse pioneer.
I've listened to the Eels for years and had absolutely no idea. But Mark described his father as a piece of furniture.
Ugh, that phrase just sticks with you. A piece of furniture. He said he was physically there, sitting in the house, chain-smoking cigarettes, drinking gin. But he was completely disconnected. He wasn't really with the family. He was living in his own parallel world, in a sense.
That image. A genius who saw all possible worlds but couldn't connect with the one he was in. Reduced to a piece of furniture. Yeah. It's haunting.
It's like the rejection of his theory just broke his connection to this reality.
And the end of his life is even more grim.
It is. Hugh Everett died of a massive heart attack at just 51 years old. He was a devout atheist, and his specific instruction in his will was to have his remains thrown in the trash.
Oh my God.
And when his son Mark found him dead in his bed, he said it was the first time he could ever remember actually touching his father.
That is just an incredibly heavy price to pay for a discovery that the world just wasn't ready for.
It is. But the legacy survived him. Years later, a physicist named Bryce DeWitt stumbled upon Everett's original thesis, realized its genius, and republished it. He was the one who coined the much catchier term, many worlds, which captured the public imagination. And today you have physicists like Max Tegmark calling Everett's work one of the most important discoveries of all time.
So Everett gave us the map, but he died before anyone believed it was real, which brings us perfectly to our second protagonist. The one who went looking for the proof. Laura Mersini-Houghton.
This is where the story shifts from, is this possible, to wait a minute, can we actually see it? And Laura Mersini-Houghton is a theoretical physicist with a fascinating backstory that really informs her science. She grew up in Albania under a brutal communist dictatorship.
Talk about a closed system.
Right. She talks about growing up seeing walls everywhere, literal and figurative. She said she developed a smoking habit just from the stress of watching her friends try to escape by climbing into foreign embassies, not knowing if they'd make it. She learned very early on that boundaries are things to be challenged and crossed.
And she brought that attitude to her work in physics.
She did. When she got into academia, she was warned, just like Everett was, not to ask the wrong questions.
Specifically, she was told, don't ask what happened before the Big Bang.
Exactly. That was considered career suicide. The dogma was. The Big Bang is the start of all time and space, so asking what came before is like asking what's north of the North Pole. It's a meaningless question.
But she ignored that advice.
She ignored it. She looked at the standard Big Bang theory and saw a massive statistical problem. It's what the course calls the lottery problem.
I love this part because it uses math to expose just how ridiculous some of our basic assumptions are.
The physicist Sir Roger Penrose calculated the odds of our specific universe with its particular laws, its specific strength of gravity, of electromagnetism, all the conditions that allow for life coming into existence by pure random chance.
And the number he came up with, I saw it in the source material, it's 10 to the power of 10 to the power 123 to 1. That's It's not just a big number. It's a functionally impossible number.
It's effectively zero. It's like a monkey sitting at a typewriter and accidentally typing out the entire U.S. legal code perfectly with all the punctuation on the very first try.
It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. So if there's only one universe, then our existence is a miracle that defies all statistical logic. We simply shouldn't be here.
Unless there are a lot of monkeys with a lot of typewriters.
Exactly. If you have a multiverse, if you have billions or trillions or an infinite number of universes all trying out different combinations of physical laws, then the odds change completely. It's like buying millions of lottery tickets. Suddenly it becomes probable that someone is going to win. We are just the winners. We find ourselves in the universe that works. Because if we were in one of the others that didn't, we wouldn't be here to ask the question.
Okay, logically that solves the math problem. It makes our existence probable rather than miraculous, but logic isn't evidence. I thought the whole definition of a universe is that we can't see outside of it. It's beyond our cosmic horizon. So how could you possibly prove it?
That was the big assumption. But Mersini-Houghton applied string theory to the origin of the universe. She theorized that our universe didn't just pop into existence alone. It began as a wave function on a vast quantum landscape, and it was entangled with other universes, a grand entanglement.
So we started out connected to these other realities.
Like twins in a cosmic womb. And she argued that the moment of separation, what physicists call decoherence, when our universe tore away to become its own independent entity, was violent. It wasn't a gentle drift apart, it was a cosmic rip. And she argued that a separation that violent must have left marks, scars on our sky.
Birthmarks of the universe. That is such a poetic, powerful image.
It is, but she made it scientific. She made very specific, falsifiable predictions about what those scars would look like in the cosmic microwave background radiation. That's the faint heat left over from the Big Bang.
What kind of predictions?
She predicted there would be a giant cold spot, a massive void in the sky where there should be energy. She predicted something called sigma 8 suppression, which is a lack of clumpiness in matter on large scales. And she predicted a strange alignment of cosmic structures that astronomers call the axis of evil.
Those sound like incredibly risky predictions. I mean, if she's wrong, her career is basically over. She's just another crank with a wild theory.
Absolutely. She made these predictions back in 2005. Then, in 2013, the European Space Agency's Planck satellite sent back the most precise, high-resolution map of the early universe ever made. And guess what they found?
Don't tell me.
There they were. The cold spot. The suppression of energy. The strange axis alignment. All confirmed. And not just confirmed, but confirmed at a 5 sigma level of statistical confidence.
Okay, 5 sigma. I hear that term a lot in these physics discussions. What does that actually mean for us non-physicists?
In particle physics, that is the gold standard for a discovery. It means there's a 1 in 3.5 million chance that the result is just a random fluke. It's effectively proof.
That is incredible. So mm-hmm. She effectively found the fingerprints of other universes that bumped into ours at the dawn of time.
She calls it the smoking gun.
Mm.
And her philosophy on all this is just beautiful. And it really speaks to the human element of this course. She said in an interview with Brian Keating that this discovery means we are just one humble member in a vast, beautiful cosmos.
I love that.
And she said that if we found out we were the only universe, it would actually be a version of hell. Because eventually we'd run out of things to explore. The multiverse means the mystery never, ever ends.
That's a fantastic perspective. It flips the idea of insignificance on its head. It's not that we don't matter. It's that the playground is infinitely bigger and more interesting than we ever thought.
Exactly. So we have the theorist, Everett, who gave us the math. We have the evidence, Mersini-Houghton, who found the scars on the sky. And now we meet our third protagonist, the builder, Hartmut Nevin.
The pragmatist. This is where we leave the chalkboard and the telescope behind and enter Silicon Valley.
This is the pragmatist. Hartmut Nevin is the head of Google's quantum AI lab, and he is not waiting for peer review to settle the philosophical debates. He isn't asking for permission. He's building machines that work on these principles.
And this isn't some isolated academic. Nevin has a serious background in neuroinformatics, computer vision. He was a key figure in Project Glass. This is a guy who builds things that have to work in the real world.
Correct. He operates in what we call the mesoscopic reality back in Class 1. He's building the bridge between the weirdness of the quantum world and our classical world. And his team at Google was the first to achieve what's called quantum supremacy.
Which means they built a quantum computer that could do something a classical computer effectively couldn't.
They built a quantum computer that solved a specific problem in seconds that would take the world's most powerful classical supercomputer thousands of years.
And this brings us to what the course calls the forcing event. How do you even explain that kind of speed? It's not just that it's a little faster, it's exponentially, ridiculously faster.
Nevin himself has suggested that the best way, maybe the only logical way, to explain how a quantum computer achieves that kind of speed is to assume it is exploiting parallel computational resources.
Meaning it's borrowing horsepower from other universes.
Or at the very least, it's behaving as if it is. The math works out. Nevin isn't just theorizing. He builds things that defy classical logic entirely. His team has created time crystals, strain deforms of matter that repeat their structure in time. Not just in space. They've simulated traversable wormholes on their quantum processors.
So these aren't just sci-fi terms to him. They are engineering components in a machine he is building.
He's using the multiverse as a resource. It's like mining for gold, but the gold is computational power from other realities.
That's a great way to put it. And this is where it all loops back to the law, because Hartmann-Nevin represents the shift in the standard of care.
Yes. Connect the dots for me. How do we get from a time crystal at Google to a lawsuit in courtroom?
This is the crucial legal connection in the course. For as long as the multiverse is just a theory in a paper by Everett or a finding by Mersini-Houghton, lawyers can safely ignore it. It's academic. It's out there. But the moment Google starts building its infrastructure based on these principles, when they build machines that rely on quantum mechanics to optimize logistics or discover new drugs or assess financial risk, it stops being a theory. It becomes the baseline for competence. So if you ignore the technology that works just because you don't like the weird philosophy behind it, you could be found negligent.
Exactly. Imagine a logistics company that fails to deliver time-sensitive medical supplies because they used a classical computer to route their trucks and they all got stuck in traffic. Meanwhile, their competitor used a quantum computer that optimized the route using all these multiverse probabilities and got there on time, every time. The first company isn't just slow. They are now arguably liable. They failed to use the best available tools.
The standard of care has shifted. The old reasonable person standard now has to account for a quantum aware person.
Or at the very least, they have to hire one.
So, okay, this is the big question. What does all of this mean for the judge sitting on the bench? We've got infinite worlds, scars on the sky, Google building time crystals. How does any of that help a judge decide a complex mass tort case?
Let's ground this because this is the heart of Class 5. Imagine a chemical exposure case. Thousands of plaintiffs claiming that a chemical released from a factory caused their cancer.
A classic toxic tort. I lived near the factory for 20 years and now I'm sick.
In the old clockwork world, the judge is looking for a direct linear chain of causation. They want to see this specific molecule entered your body and flipped this specific genetic switch. The judge wants identity. They want to rewind the clock and say, but for that chemical, there would be no cancer.
But in reality, and especially in quantum reality, that simple chain just doesn't exist.
It doesn't. What you have is statistical risk. You have confidence intervals. You have probability distributions. The defense attorneys will say, well, maybe it was the chemical, but maybe it was genetics. Maybe it was their diet. Maybe it was just bad luck. It's all a cloud of competing probabilities.
So no single plaintiff can ever prove identity. That absolute rewound the clock certainty. So if a judge demands that old standard, the plaintiffs lose every single time.
Every single time. And the judge have a choice. They can wait for a certainty that will never ever come because the universe isn't built that way. Or they can learn to make decisions based on probability.
But if they just wait for certainty, they're effectively ruling for the defendant by doing nothing. Not deciding is a decision.
Precisely. And this is where the judge becomes the observer.
I love this metaphor. Explain how that works in the legal context.
In quantum physics, the wave function, that cloud of all possibilities, exists in a state of superposition until an observer measures it. The measurement forces it to collapse into one single definite reality.
Right.
In the courtroom, the case itself is a wave function. You have conflicting stories, conflicting probabilities, conflicting expert witnesses. It's all swirling in a superposition of liable and not liable. The judge, by signing the order, by entering a judgment, forces that wave function to collapse.
So the judgment is an act of decoherence.
It is. The judge is forcing the multiverse of legal possibilities into a single binding reality for those parties. They are taking the chaos of probability and stamping the word fact onto it for the purpose of justice.
And this brings us to that concept of the control loop. We touched on this back in Class 4, but it seems like this is the final piece of the puzzle.
It is. If we accept that we can't control the individual particles, if we can't trace that single deterministic chain from A to B, then we have to manage the system as a whole. Lawyers and judges are the humans in the loop. We don't micromanage the electron. We set the parameters. We monitor the output. We decide what level of risk is acceptable for society.
So we're not really looking for truth with a capital T anymore. We're not trying to get the absolute God's eye view of what happened.
We are looking for legitimacy. That is the key shift. Justice has never actually required absolute certainty. Think about the highest standard of proof we have in criminal law. Beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right. It's not beyond all doubt. The word reasonable is doing a lot of work there.
A huge amount of work. That phrase literally implies that a shadow of doubt remains. We accept that the shadow exists. The legal question is, how large a shadow are we as a society willing to tolerate?
There's a great line in the source material referencing the old radio show.
Yes. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows. It's a bit of fun pop culture, but the point is profound. Law is the practice of deciding how large that shadow of doubt can be while still calling the outcome justice. In civil cases, the shadow can be almost 49%. In criminal cases, it has to be much, much smaller. But it's always there.
You know, hearing it framed that way feels like a massive relief, actually. It takes the pressure off. We aren't failing because we can't achieve perfect certainty. We're just operating within the fundamental rules of reality.
That is the liberation of quantum law. Once you accept probability as the foundation, you stop chasing ghosts.
So, looking back at this entire course, why should a lawyer or a judge or a business person take it? Why do they need to know about Hugh Everett and the cold spot in the sky?
To be the observer who knows what they're doing. To be the one who can handle the shadow of infinity. If you cling to the old clockwork model, you're going to be obsolete. You're going to be looking for simple gears in a world that is made of complex waves.
And on a more practical level, we talked about Q-Day back in class two. That threat hasn't gone away.
On a practical level, you need to be ready for the moment all current encryption breaks. You need to understand the threat of harvest now, decrypt later. And you need to understand that intellectual property law is about to get incredibly messy. Just look at the recent bankruptcy of Zapata AI.
Tell me about that. What happened there?
They were a real pioneer in industrial generative AI. They had amazing math, amazing algorithms, but they couldn't monetize it fast enough, and the company went under. It shows the fragility of this whole sector. How do you value an algorithm that is inherently noisy and probabilistic? How do you protect IP when the invention is a probability distribution, not a blueprint for a machine? If you don't understand the underlying physics, you can't value the company, and you can't write the contract to protect it.
It seems like the biggest takeaway is that probability isn't a flaw in the system. It's not just that we don't know enough yet to be certain. It is the system. It is the structure of reality.
That is the fundamental shift in worldview. Once you truly accept that, you stop fighting for an impossible certainty and you start building robust, legitimate systems that can handle the truth of the process. That is the shift from identity to fidelity.
Now, before we wrap up, I have to ask about the fireside chat. The course creator, Ralph Aluzzi, offers something pretty unique at the end of this journey.
It's a wonderful touch, and it really separates this from a typical CLE or some dry university course.
Yeah.
It's not a lecture. It's not legal advice. It is definitely not a billable hour. It's an informal one-on-one conversation, a fireside chat for anyone who completes the course.
So just a chance to talk to a colleague about all these mind-bending ideas.
Exactly. Ralph wants to discuss the why with you. He wants to talk about life and law and the multiverse without the pressure of a client deadline or a legal argument. It's a rare thing in our profession to just explore ideas, to ask the big questions like, okay, if the multiverse is real, what does that mean for my soul? What does that mean for my ethics as a lawyer?
It's a throwback to the old days of natural philosophy. Lawyers used to be philosophers.
We should be again. This is our chance.
So as we close the book on Class 5 and on the quantum law course as a whole, I want to leave our listeners with one final thought. We've talked about infinite worlds. We've talked about scars on the sky. It's easy to feel small in all of this. It's easy to feel like nothing matters if everything that can happen does happen somewhere.
That's a real risk. Nihilism is a real risk. But let's go back to Laura Mersini-Houghton. She finds beauty and meaning in it. And let's ask the question directly. If the multiverse exists, does that mean there are other versions of us out there?
Statistically, it seems there would have to be.
Maybe. Maybe there's a version of you that didn't take this deep dive today. Maybe there's a version of me that became a musician instead of a lawyer. But does that dilute our responsibility here in this world?
I would argue it does the opposite. I think it heightens it.
I completely agree. We are responsible for justice in this branch of reality. We are the custodians of this timeline. There's a quote from the course conclusion that I think just sums it all up perfectly. It says, "Physics tells us there may be many worlds. Your profession is the promise that justice can be found in this one."
That gives me chills.
Yeah.
Truly, that is such a powerful call to action. It grounds all of this high-flying physics right back into the courtroom, right back to our daily work.
It is. And remember Hugh Everett. Remember that comment about him being a piece of furniture? Great discovery can have a profound human cost. We have to be better than that. We have to be present. We have to be the observers who actually care. We can't be pieces of furniture in our own lives, even if we are thinking about the multiverse.
We can't repeat the past. We can't rewind that clock. But we can be faithful to the truth of the process. fidelity over identity.
You are the observer. You are the one who collapses the wave function. Make it count.
Thank you for taking this deep dive with us. It has been a journey from the qubit to the cosmos and back again. The future of quantum law is here, and it is more fascinating than I ever imagined. We'll see you in the next reality.